Welcome, welcome to Freaked Out with your co-hosts, Liz and Landon.
What's up, everybody?
Today, guys, we are so excited. We're going to be covering the second installment of Jack the Ripper. We have been dying to get into this since we started the first episode because it's been so much fun. And I'll tell you, it's been a heavy roller coaster the last couple of months. And I am trying to take a bit of a break on those heavy children cases. Even covering the Idaho 4 was tough. So you're going to notice a couple of fun, loving episodes coming your way. And I know that you guys go through the emotions with me as well. So it's okay. We're going to have fun. And that's what it's all about.
It's actually really interesting because although there are a lot of Ripperologists out there, it is very disorganized to try to find any links. So we're going to try to make this as uncomplicated as possible.
Uncomplicated. Sounds like a plan. Although I'll tell you guys, it's been really neat because the last episode of Jack the Ripper, we connected to his first victim, right? Polly, but Dark Annie has been so significant. Let me put it this way to you. The best personality we can describe her as is Harley Quinn. That's the kind of energy I get from her. It's like she's been pretty insane. It looks like she actually carried on her insanity energy into the afterlife. When it comes to Eileen, a lot of you guys have asked me like if her energy is crazier than Eileen's. And I have to say yes, because even though Eileen has a lot of mental health issues, she wasn't insane. Dark Annie is extremely insane.
Yikes, and that's saying a lot. You know, I can't wait for us to get into this episode and get started. Seems like it's going to be interesting.
She hides it well, or at least she hid it well when she was alive anyway, not so much now. She loves hearing her name. So if anyone ever calls upon her name, Annie, Dark Annie, she'll come running if you ever want her around, of course. Give her a shout out. She'll definitely show up some way, somehow.
She is somebody that I get the feeling that will probably hang out around us quite a bit. Maybe she'll hang out with Tiffany or something.
You know, that's not a half bad idea because she actually has the blonde hair. She's got that Tiffany Valentine energy for sure.
Well, in that case, we'll cover that aspect of things a little bit later if we can get her to attach to Tiffany. But that'll probably be more closer on our YouTube channel. So you guys will have to go down to get that yourself on the YouTube side of things.
Oh, yeah. And as of right now, this moment, the channel's called Freaked Out Tube. But by the time Friday rolls around, or maybe even in the next couple days, we're going to be changing it to Freaked Out Inc. So just be aware of that. And I have no idea how to get spirits into dolls. I don't know anything in relation to that. All I know is that when the kids are like, connect me with a baby doll, I'll buy their dolls. Like Kaylee has a doll and, you know, she's referring to this doll. Now Harmony has her own doll. They're all, you know, children spirits that are attaching themselves to these dolls, but this is just a little different, so we'll see what happens. I think it'll be fun.
Well, she sounds like the type of person that would definitely attach themselves to something and stay with us for sure.
Oh, yeah. Now, Dark Annie is all about the show. She wants everyone's eyes and attention on her. She wears deep, heavy makeup with bright red lips. Her hair is blonde, but she also has like the streak of the brunette shining through because she used to be one. She's quite the bosoms on her. She wears a very tight corset. She still wears the Victorian style clothes, but it's quite ratted. And she was probably one of those more promiscuous women when it comes to being his victims. She didn't fight back too much, but we'll talk about that a little later. She says she was carrying large amounts of diseases and she didn't give a shit. Oh my. She would often lift up her skirt and perform some sort of, well, circus act with her vagina. She could maneuver things like, you know, hold items there, crush things. She says it was an art. And she never got to express her art, at least in the way she wanted when it came to what her vagina was capable of doing.
Well, on that note, I guess let's get started. The most famous serial killer of all time, JTR, better known as Jack the Ripper, decided to strike again while roaming the dirt streets of Whitechapel.
Oh, absolutely. People were already afraid of him, and he only had one person killed, ripping a bloody path through the women of the night.
Well, let's go back to that Victorian era in London late night back in the day. He would probably be wearing, you know, a three-piece suit with a matching waistcoat and trousers and a proper top hat, as all Victorian gentlemen should have worn back then.
I just have to say, if you already go by the name of Annie in your own life, she loves that energy. Even the name Eliza, but that's for something different. She feels like you guys are already a part of her.
I guess all the Annies in the world.
Probably a few who aren't really taking care of their children and carrying on a filthy home. She may not necessarily be interested in people like that, but she definitely feels connected to those who have her name. She also likes every single Annie that has a dark, twisted sense of humor.
Well, that's very interesting. Now, Annie Chapman, also known as Dark Annie, was born Eliza Ann Smith on September 25th of 1841 in Paddington, London. She was the daughter of George Smith, a soldier, and Ruth Chapman. Annie had a challenging childhood marked by poverty and struggles. She later married John Chapman, a coachman, in 1869, but their marriage was troubled and they eventually separated in 1884. I mean, they both had the same last name. Maybe they were cousins.
We'll get into that a little later. Now, from what she shows me, it comes from her poor and poverty-ridden life that she never gave up, or she thought that no matter what was going to happen, she was going to be someone special. She also shows me that this was before she became insane. She says, although we all know the story of Jack the Ripper, we do not know the background story, and that she plans to tell us all. She does not have any interest in holding back. Clearly, since she told us about her vagina tricks, let's start off right now. She'd like to talk about her childhood. There's a very unusual man that lived down the road who would take interest in her. From what she shows me, he would often rape her. She shows me that she would try to make money, and he was like a librarian or something to that effect. She would go and look for work, but instead of getting work, she would often get paid for silence when he would rape her. Although she didn't feel comfortable with the rape, obviously she was happy to make a little cash, bringing home money for her family. She felt accomplished, even if it was just a few shillings.
That is fucked up.
Yeah, she's quite forward. She basically is saying that he couldn't get it up for his wife. He would look at his wife like she was a younger version of his mother, and it really freaked him out.
That's even worse. Like, how old was Annie at this time?
She shows me she was approximately 10 to 11 years old. Practically a woman, she says.
Well, not according to our standards these days, but sure, definitely not. It was also said, a true statement by her brother, Fountain, that he had taken a drink when she was quite young and quickly developed a weakness for alcohol.
She says, and I quote, "My brother needs to learn to mind his own fucking business. And what the fuck did you expect me to do? I was being raped weekly, of course. I'm trying to take the edge off."
I mean, yeah, she definitely could have did way worse there. Now, Annie Chapman got married to John James Chapman, who was related to her own mother. There we go.
How wonderful to marry into her own family and had three kids.
Emily Ruth and Annie Georgina and John Alfred, little John, had been born crippled, but not exactly sure what took place there. I mean, probably the family genetics.
Makes sense.
Intertwining family genetics there.
Close related fucking people.
But the Chapmans did not seek out any medical help for their son before placing him in the care of an institution for the physically disabled. I mean, yeah, you can't really do much back then with a disabled child.
She shows me that it was a very dark time for her. She didn't want to give up her rights to her son or place him in any sort of institution because she had seen and heard the nightmares from those places, but truly felt like she had no choice. It was almost as if the parents were basically told they had no rights or know how to take care of a crippled baby, and they basically said they needed to take care of him, at least for now.
Now, according to sources, her alcoholism took a turn due to what took place with her son and had a high alcoholic dependency, which I get. Not only did she have all this traumatic stuff happen to her in her life, she also now has to give up her crippled son.
She says that her husband was also very angry about this and would often complain. So they figured that they would just move elsewhere, which they did. And then something more tragic took place. Her daughter, Ruth, died of meningitis on her brother's second birthday when she was only 12 years old.
You know, I could understand how she gave up on just about everything at this point, you know, following the death of her daughter now. Both Annie and John took to heavy drinking. And over the years, she's known to have been arrested on several occasions for public intoxication. And although no records exist of her ever being brought there before court, there are some arrests there. I mean, I could see why all this tragic again happening with all this stuff.
Oh, yeah. They took her to the drunk tank and basically let her go. It wasn't worth the paperwork. They often all felt terrible for what she had gone through in life, so they just kind of gave her a pass. She also wants to point out that the day that her daughter died was when she believed the insanity began, and she didn't give a shit and still doesn't give a shit.
I mean, sadly, you know, the two of them, John and Annie, separated by mutual consent. John did retain custody of their surviving daughter because he was the person who seemed to be holding it together more than Annie was.
Now, from what Annie shows me, he may have been quitting drinking at this point, or at least quit drinking enough to take care of their daughter. And she felt as though she was a curse. Like, she felt as though if she was around Annie, you know, it would just make things worse. She probably would find a way to kill her daughter as well. So therefore, not really affected by this too much. She didn't mind her daughter being cared for by her ex-husband.
She was also able to get a weekly allowance of, you know, 10 shillings via post office order. And although it's not indicated why the couple's separation took place, it was claimed that Chapman's drunken and immoral ways were really the reason why.
She says, I can tell you exactly what happened. She says that she had sex with pretty much anyone she knew and who he knew. His friends, his brother. She did it on purpose and in front of him because he had no reaction to Emily's death. So she kept fucking her way through life. She even says that she did it for shits and giggles. She found the old man that raped her and had sex with him as well. She said she would plan these little events for when John would come home, and never once was there a reaction other than the separation. And even then, there was no reaction to it. The only reason John had left her was because he didn't want her daughter to witness all of this inappropriate, drunken sexual behavior.
I mean, yeah, that sounds like a responsible parent right there.
Yeah.
I'd say that's definitely a good reason for somebody to get separated. I'd do the same.
Absolutely. She said she often wished John dead. She believed she manifested it because later on, only a few short years later, he died of liver cirrhosis and died on December 25th. Which ended up stopping her weekly payments.
I mean, yeah, you were getting them because your husband was giving them to you. So now it says that she found out about her husband's death by her brother-in-law, which I am assuming is somebody that she was also in cahoots with in the bedroom as well.
She says that all that information, including your assumptions, was correct. Her surviving daughter, Annie, is to believe to have been placed in a French institution or may have joined a performing troupe which traveled with a circus in France. But later on, it was revealed that both Annie's children, including her disabled son, ended up living with their grandma.
So she didn't run off to the circus then?
Perhaps no, but I don't know. I'm thinking maybe she did at some point, maybe a little bit after she left Grandmama's house, you know? I'm truly believing that there's seriously some truth to the circus because Annie is like giggling like a son of a bitch over here.
Well, over the following year, she had resided in common lodging houses in both Whitechapel and Spritzfield by 1886. She was known to have resided with a man who made wire sheaves for a living.
What is a wire sheave?
It's typically a basket made from metal fine mesh. Its job is to separate dry ingredients like flour and cocoa powder, and also powdered sugar, which will lead to lighter and more tender crumb in baked goods.
Oh, I see why I'm totally out of the loop on that. I had no idea, but good to know. Thank you for educating myself and anyone else who has no idea what the hell that was.
So when her weekly allowance abruptly stopped, so did her relationship with that man. And then also on top of that, she had found out that her husband also died of these alcohol-related issues.
And she was giggling when he died, by the way. That's when Annie says that he was an absolute hypocrite because he was better at hiding his alcoholic ways. Her friends told her that, hey, you know, you've become a lot more depressed. And she seemed to really lose her will to live. And she used to sell things like crocheted items, but they weren't selling.
Now there are going to be a lot of names that we are going to bring up here. And some of these names may be brought up later on in other episodes. Now, 8 days prior to Dark Annie's death, she had fought with a fellow crossing lodger who resided at a lodge house by the name of Eliza Cooper.
Wait a minute. So you're telling me that a person by the name Annie and a person by the name Liz had a falling out?
Well, Eliza, but yes. The two were reportedly rivals for the affection of a man. Now, although Eliza later claimed that the reason that the two had been fighting was because Annie had borrowed a bar of soap from her, and after being asked to return it, she had simply thrown a penny on the kitchen table and stated, "Go and get half a penny worth of soap."
Oh, yes. This is where it gets good, apparently. That's really offended Eliza. And later in the physical altercation between the two of them, Eliza struck Annie in the face and chest, in resulting her sustaining a black eye and a bruised breast.
I mean, I can only imagine how people would react to this type of fighting.
"Let's get back and have this conversation," she says, "shall we?" As she rolls up her sleeves. First of all, she says that this indeed had been fighting over a man. And the borrowing of a soap before they both realized they were interested in the same person. It was a moment. A bar of soap these days that, you know, obviously it's not like a big thing. But they didn't have any money. They barely got to bathe. Annie shows me that it was quite simple. She only used a bar of soap when she was going to be in the presence of a man. And she also wants people to know the same evening that Eliza was supposed to be in the presence of this man, she refused to give her the bar of soap because she wanted Eliza to stink. And this man had been with her the night before. She was hoping it would stop him from being with Eliza, and from what I gather, it certainly did. Annie is quite proud of this moment.
Now, on September 7th, Amelia Palmer encountered Annie on Dorset Street, and Amelia later informed police that Annie had appeared visibly pale on the occasion of having been discharged from the casual ward of the Whitechapel Infirmary that day.
Yes, and she had been complaining to Amelia for having felt too ill to do anything.
Now, after her death occurred, the coroner had actually conducted an autopsy and noted that her lungs and brain membrane were in the advanced stages of a disease which would have killed her within a few months anyways.
Which now leads us to the date of the murder. Now, there's a lot of details here, so sit back and register all this information if you can. According to both the lodging house's deputy, Timothy Donovan, and the watchman, Jonathan Evans, shortly after midnight on September 8th, Annie had been lacking the required amount of money for the nightly lodging.
Now, similar to Polly, Polly also did not have the money to lodge that evening as well, so she was ultimately murdered because of that.
Exactly. She drank a pint of beer in the kitchen with a fellow lodger, Frederick Stevens, at approximately 12 a.m. before informing another lodger that she had earlier visited her sister and her family had given her 5 shillings.
Now, Frederick noticed that Annie took a box of pills from her pocket and the box then broke. And Annie wrapped the pills in a section of an envelope she had taken from the mantelpiece before leaving the property.
At approximately 1:35 a.m., returning to the lodging house with a baked potato, which she did eat before leaving the premises with a likely intention to earn money to pay for the bed via prostituting herself, she also made the statement for them to keep a bed for her.
Now, Miss Elizabeth Long testified at the subsequent inquest into Annie's murder that she had noticed Annie talking with a man at approximately 5:30 in the morning, and the two of them stood just beyond the backyard of 29 Hanbury Street. Now, Long described this man to be over 40 years old, slightly taller, dark hair, and foreign, shabby, gentle appearance.
She also heard the man asking Annie, "Will you?" And Annie replied, "Yes."
Now, if she was, in fact, the last person to see Annie, she was likely the last person to see her alive in the company of maybe the murderer.
Shortly after 5 a.m. on the 8th of September, the son of a resident at 29 Hanbury Street, John Richardson, entered the backyard of the property to check the padlock cellar in the yard to make sure it was still intact and to trim loose pieces of leather from his boots.
He then exited the property via the front door approximately 3 minutes later, having not proceeded beyond the steps in the backyard. And at approximately 5:15 a.m., a tenant of 27 Hanbury Street, Albert Kaddish, later informed police that he had heard a woman say, "No, no," before hearing the sound of something or someone falling against a fence dividing the backyards of number 27 and 29, and he did not investigate any of the sounds.
Shocking. Annie's mutilated body was discovered shortly after 6 a.m. by an elderly resident of 29 Hanbury by the name of John Davis. John noticed the front door was now open while the back door was shut. Her body was laying on the ground near the doorway of the backyard and her head approximately 6 inches from the steps of the property. John alerted 3 men, James Green, James Kent, and Harry Holland, to his discovery before all 3 men ran down the commercial street to find a policeman as John reported his discovery to the nearest police station.
Now, at the corner of the street, all of the men found Divisional Inspector Lunis Chandler and told him another woman has been murdered. Chandler followed the men to Annie's body before requesting the assistance of the police surgeon, Dr. George Baxter Phillips, and some more officers.
Now, Dr. Phillips was quickly able to establish a defined link between Chapman's murder and Polly's murder, which was only happening like 9 days prior, and Polly had suffered deep lashes to the throat from left to right, and there was also the same similar design on Annie's throat as well in both murders.
Now, Dr. Phillips also observed that 6 areas of blood splatter up upon the wall of the house between the steps and the wooden paving dividing unit 27 and 29. The splatters were approximately 18 inches, 2 pills, which Annie had prescribed for her lung condition, and a section of the torn envelope with a small piece of frayed muslin and a comb recovered close to her body and a leather apron, partly submerged in a dish of water, located close to a tap, was also discovered and also by her body.
A very strange part of this case as well was that some contemporary press reported that there was also 2 farthings that were found in the yard. I believe it's a coin, like money. Anyways, in any surviving police records in 1889, the police major, Harry Smith, also referred to these coins in his memoir written 20 years ago, but they believe that they were both unreliable and embellishments for dramatic effect.
Now, due to the leather apron being a part of the investigation, there was somebody by the name of Leather Apron, or at least that's what people called him, and his name was also John Richardson. People linked him to the murder. Now, this apron was placed there by his mother, who had just washed it on September 6th. Now, he was investigated through the police, but was eliminated from the inquiry. Nonetheless, reported the discovery of this apron fueled by local rumors, which had been published by the Star, that a Jew from the district known as Leather Apron was responsible for this murder.
Clearly, these people were, you know, not sympathetic to Jewish immigrants coming to Whitechapel. And although many people hounded John for many, many, many years to come, Dark Annie over here has indicated that she has many moments with this particular job. And she says that he couldn't hurt a fly. And although extremely creepy and definitely had his fascination with knives, he was not her suitor. She has zero interest in him ever giving her the time of day. She also says that although he did have a connection to his mother, Annie tells me that he definitely did fit the criteria, but she says he was not the man that murdered her. And yes, this man definitely had some confidence issues. She shows me that he was somebody who she had sex with prior, just like Polly. They both have very similar stories surrounding this man. He was someone they knew. He knew his way around a knife. He was someone who worked around biology and fascination. And after the murders of these women, he would play with their bodies. He was rather quick. He showed me that this man had a very hard time looking into her eyes. She had seen him multiple times hanging out. Somebody that couldn't just walk up to prostitutes and be like, hey, let's go. She says he was never someone to just do that. She would actually have to be the one to start the conversation, and so were the other women. He lacked confidence, and although she says that he would carry a book, she would often see him writing in this book, which made sense because he wrote a book, and asked him about his book. She says that she was a woman. She did, you know, do some things. She tried to take his book, and she says that he threatened to kill her with a knife. If she ever did it again, she enjoyed that, thought it was like foreplay. You know what I mean? She thought he was just kidding, though. She didn't take it to heart. She says that he was very interested in sex games, and she would often make it that way. She could do things with, like I said, with her vagina, and he was a willing participant. She also was a bit heavier set, and she also shows me she believed that he was referring to her as the woman in his book that he had sex with on multiple occasions.
Do you feel anything on who you think this guy is quite yet?
It's interesting because although Jack the Ripper has only technically been recorded as one person, I'm thinking there might even be two people connected. It's just way too simple for one man to get away with all of this in such a short amount of time. And the other thing I'm pretty sure of is our dear friend Eliza, you know, the one that kicked Annie's ass. I truly believe that Eliza has a significant connection to Jack the Ripper as well. From what I can see, Eliza had been screaming and bitching to just about every single person she could about this event that took place with her and Annie, and she really never shut her mouth up. So I don't necessarily feel like Eliza, like, sent him after her, but she talked to him and she talked his ear off, and I feel like he was intrigued by Annie, and more so than ever decided that she would be victim number two.
Well, the reports also indicate that Annie did not put much of a fight up either.
That's the twisted part about it. Although she had no fight in her, she was enjoying herself while being mutilated. In fact, she asked him to do more. And although she screamed no when it came to actual death itself, she was very interested in carving her body and mutilating it. He was whispering things in her ears about cutting out her spleen, which, by the way, I believe he did do something like her intestines. He told her exactly what he was going to do to her, and she was, in fact, turned on so badly she had an orgasm right then and there.
Jesus. Well, you know, until he started playing out that fantasy and actually doing it.
She shows me that she was blindfolded, and I went back to Polly and asked her if she was blindfolded, and she said she was as well. So it's interesting that both of these women would have been blindfolded right before the murders. Annie also wanted to point out that she never ended up having sex with him on this particular evening. She says he made it a point and wanted to make it all about her.
Well, he didn't want to leave any DNA behind, is from what I'm guessing. Now, I have some questions. Were the items found, like the comb and stuff, was that his?
I truly believe it was, and from what Annie shows me after she had been murdered maliciously, he truly did not have a lot of time to finish, which is why I think there was a second person. He may have been interrupted, or they may have been interrupted, by a drunk passerby and never came forward and expressed that he was there. She was yelling and screaming and being extremely belligerent, and the two of them, while dead Annie and Jack the Ripper, were outside in this particular spot, which, by the way, is where he killed her publicly this time. I feel as though he sliced her body up publicly as well, and he did not take that risk with Polly. It was a little bit more discreet where he moved her body. He did not have enough time to collect all of his items this time, though.
Now, is he someone that watches things go down, like with the police?
Absolutely. Annie says that after this particular murder of her death, he went home very quickly, which was not far from where the body was, got dressed up in his finest clothes, and went out on the streets and watched this all unfold.
Wow. Now, do you think that this person could be Dr. Phillips, since Dr. Phillips has so much expertise in the medical field?
I don't believe it's Dr. Phillips, but I believe that it's some sort of association with Dr. Phillips. Perhaps they know each other. Everyone knows this particular person. Although he's not someone who stands out publicly, he does like to keep a low profile, but, you know, it's a small place. People often know who each other are, especially if they've been around their whole life. And although he was usually considered weird and unlike a character that he writes himself to be in his book.
I mean, he's got to do his own fantasy to stand out, to be somebody special, but maybe it's like the apprentice of the doctor, or even like the morgue person that like embalms the bodies or something.
It's very possible. And it's very interesting. Annie expresses that she greatly appreciated Jack the Ripper. If it was not for him, she would have been nothing and nobody on the map. She appreciated the way he killed her. She says he did it tastefully and respectfully. She's happy she reunited with her children, especially Emily. She loved Emily very much, and the two of them roam the streets of London together, and apparently she sometimes hangs out with Jack the Ripper. What?
Yikes. Well, I cannot wait to put all these pieces together.
There is so much more. But Annie also wants everyone to know that she knows exactly who killed her, and his name and everything connected to him. But she will not submit these details because she looks at him like a hero. She feels as though his identity should be kept quiet, and it's more interesting that way. But that's okay. I think we have a few other victims that do not fantasize about this romantically, and we'll figure it out.
Well, I'm definitely enjoying this Jack the Ripper series. I'm sure we'll be back for part 3 very soon. Next week, we will be covering the episode of the Illuminati part 3, and this is most likely going to be the last installment that we're going to do here on the podcast, only because we're going to be solely dedicating a large amount of our time on our new YouTube channel, and we'll probably talk about it more over there. So please make sure to go and take a listen and follow us there. You guys will not regret it. We have so much more coming out your way. Now, until next time, guys, stay freaked out.